Have some fun, Joyce.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and I'm delighted to have you with me today. Today we're going to talk about anesthesia. And this is a topic that I think is going to be relevant to all of us at some point in our lives, even if it's just in a dental chair or for a cosmetic procedure or for something more serious when they put you to sleep or otherwise make it so that you won't feel the pain. There are some concerns that we don't always think about, and Dr. Barry Friedberg is going to be with us today to talk about that. I work primarily with a group of people that have a condition called von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, which means that they're more likely to get tumors in six different parts of the body than your average person. And so my switchboard is not quite working tonight, so I don't know that I can play you my little theme song. So let me tell you a little bit about VHL. And as a matter of fact, we have a new animation on YouTube. So if you like little cartoons, please go to www.youtube.com/VHLFA. for VHL Family Alliance, and you'll find a little cartoon there that you can play about VHL. But basically, it's one bitty little misspelling in one gene that causes people to be at greater risk for certain kinds of tumors. And we always wondered why these parts of the body, the retina, the brain, the spinal cord, the kidney, the pancreas, and the adrenal glands, what do they all have in common? Well, it turns out that they're particularly rich in blood vessels, and the operant mechanism that causes these tumors is a mechanism called angiogenesis, and you've seen that in the press lately. It's one of the primary mechanisms that can lead to cancer, and so the research on VHL is actually unlocking a lot of secrets of cancer in the general population, and we're working hard to try to find the secrets of angiogenesis and learn how to control this process, which will be good for anybody who might be at risk for cancer, which is unfortunately a pretty sizable chunk of the population. So please check out vhl.org, and we will look forward to your support. And the VHL Family Alliance brings you this program every week in order to share with you some of what we've learned about managing our health and getting through a series of surgeries your whole life, and living a good life in spite of all that. So today I'd like to welcome Dr. Barry Friedberg. Hello, Dr. Friedberg.
Hello, Joyce.
Hi.
Good evening.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you.
So it's great to have you with us today. Thank you. So you're an anesthesiologist, as I understand?
Yes, I'm a board-certified anesthesiologist in practice 33 years.
33 years, wow. That's a sizable career here. So I'm sure you've learned a lot about what can go right and what can go wrong. And you had some words of wisdom for all of us patients or potential patients out there of how we can stay safe through experiences with anesthesia. Can you tell us a little about that, please?
Yes, ma'am. You have to understand the basic concepts of what we're doing in anesthesia, which is to try to render your brain unconscious and unable to feel pain. Before 1996, we had no direct way to measure what was going on in your brain, so what we did have is a series of vital signs, your heart rate, your blood pressure, cardiogram, and pulse oximeter, which are wonderful clues to everything that's going on in your body from the neck down, but the anesthetics are designed to medicate you from the neck up. So it's a pretty self-evident proposition that without direct brain measurement, the anesthesiologist is obliged to give you more medicine than he thinks you need for fear of giving you too little. This week I was involved in an article at CNN.com on anesthesia awareness, but anesthesia awareness is one side of the same coin of anesthesia over medication. Both things happen when you fail to measure the organ that the drugs are designed to medicate, and that's, of course, the brain. I think I'll take a breath
now. That's very interesting. Now, in the community that I serve, We get a lot of brain surgeries, and my understanding is that you, because there are no nerve endings in the brain, you really don't have to give anybody as much anesthesia for brain surgery as you do, for example, for abdominal surgery. Is that true?
Well, technically speaking, that's true. The brain tissue itself has no pain endings, but the skin that invests or wraps around the skull and the lining of the brain, the meninges, do have pain fibers.
Right.
But craniotomies, for instance, have historically been able to be performed on awake patients as long as you use numbing medication in the skin to get through the skin and numb up the periosteum, which is the lining of the bone, and then also the meninges. So once you get into the brain, per se, the brain tissue itself has no brain endings. You're correct.
Right, but if they're working on your abdominal cavity, there are tons of nerve endings down there, and so it takes a lot more anesthesia to keep you asleep. Is that right?
Yes, but the concept that I try to advance to people is that if you don't block the skin, the stimulation of the skin signal, then you've really lost the battle as far as postoperative pain management goes. One of the things
about
defining anesthesia, of course, is we talk about rendering the patient unconscious and unable to feel pain. But the Goldilocks anesthetic that I developed allows patients to not have pain with that incision, and so when they wake up after surgery, they look remarkably different than patients who haven't had that particular approach. The skin.
So now, anesthesia can be things that don't necessarily put you to sleep, too, right? So like Novocaine is in the range of anesthesia?
Yes, that's a local anesthetic, and then there's
right.
intravenous anesthetics and inhalational anesthetics, things you breathe or things that we put in your vein, and they all have somewhat different actions and mechanisms. There's also using local anesthetic around the spinal cord called epidurals or spinal anesthetics as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but the objective is that you don't feel pain.
Right, and the problem is that when I talk to people about what I do versus what they do, I said if you're still giving your patients or if your patients still need powerful painkillers in the recovery room like morphine or Vicodin, and my patients are still taking Tylenol and Motrin, then you might have something to learn from what I'm doing. The problem is the post-operative
pain. So tell us about what you're doing.
Well, what we're doing is we're providing a set of circumstances whereby that initial stimulation never gets to the patient's brain. In other words, most people have had their teeth numbed at the dentist, and you know before the teeth go numb, they actually hurt. The pain hurts. The injection hurts. And much the same with a skin incision, whether it's in the abdomen or on the skull, once you open the skin, the nerve fibers on either side of that incision start talking back to the brain saying, invasion, invasion, perimeter has been breached. Skin, of course, is the largest organ in the body, and we have the most number of nerves. So it's not simply the stimulation of the skin incision itself, but it's the communication from the nerves at the skin on either side that keep talking to the brain. And what happens under typical general anesthesia is called the wind-up phenomenon, and that is the brain keeps being bombarded by this information that the perimeter has been invaded, and when the depressant medication is released and the patient wakes up in recovery room, the brain says, hey, somebody was hurting me while I was asleep. And therefore, they need powerful painkillers like morphine and Vicodin and things like that. Whereas with what I'm doing, the patient never gets that information. The patient's brain never receives that information. And so they don't need any powerful painkillers. And I've been doing this now for 13 years on a reproducible basis.
So what is it that you're doing before the incision? There's some blocking going on?
Yes. Before the incision, the patient is made unconscious with a drug called propofol on a very continuous infusion. The propofol level is measured, the activity is measured in the brain by the brain monitor, which has a scale from 0 to 100. And once you're down at 75 or lower, a second drug called ketamine is given 3 minutes before either the skin incision or the injection in the skin before the incision is made. And this, it turns out to be a huge, huge advantage to the patient because if the brain doesn't get any information, it can't wind up while you're asleep. So there's a very profound difference between what's called dissociative anesthesia, which is what I'm doing, and the typical general anesthesia whereby they're giving you propofol with a narcotic like fentanyl or alfentanil, or an inhalational agent like sevoflurane, desflurane, or isoflurane. Those are very commonly used.
So you called it dissociative anesthesia.
Yes. Ketamine had such a bad reputation after it was introduced in 1971 that many patients had had bad dreams on it and flashbacks that anesthesiologists were obliged to develop a code word to describe any anesthetic technique that used the drug ketamine. In the 18 years that I've been advocating its use, of course, we've managed to rehabilitate the drug so that, as opposed to the way the manufacturer introduced the drug as the complete total intravenous anesthetic, it's really the ideal olive in the martini, and the propofol is the ideal martini. But you have to know how to measure and when to give, and then it makes a world of difference.
Okay, so part of what has changed over the years is the way that it's formulated, and part of it is the way it's measured and administered?
Yes, and without measurement, you can't reproducibly get what you're trying to achieve, which is all the good effects of the ketamine and none of the bad effects. That ketamine is like putting a fence, if you will, a blocking thing about the level of your ears so that the top of your head, your brain, where the cerebral cortex is, never gets the information that somebody is violating the perimeter or the skin. It's a very huge paradigm shift and something that I've been working on for 18 years and have received a lot of accolades, including a congressional award, because this is so safe a technique that they're able to use it even on wounded soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Great. So is this in common use in most hospitals or not?
Not. But there are more and more people who've come around to the point of view that it's preferable not to allow your patients, your unconscious and helpless patients, to have pain inflicted on them. And that's kind of the story that I try to explain to my colleagues and my surgeons in surgical meetings and anesthesiologists in anesthesia meetings, that it becomes kind of a moral duty, really, if you're serious about your work, that you don't want to allow pain to reach the patient's brain. And just because they're unconscious and unable to move doesn't mean that their brain isn't getting information. And the acid test is always what comes out at the other end. Well, if my patients haven't needed narcotics, powerful pain-killing narcotics like morphine for 13 years because of what I'm doing, and you're still doing that, then clearly we're doing something profoundly different for our patients.
So what we thought we were experiencing is that when you wake up from the surgery, you have pain from the incision, from the work that was done internally. So if they repaired an organ or something, we have a wounded kidney or so, whatever, that is yelling about that. And so a lot of the pain is sourced within the operating field. You're saying,
right,
though, that part of the pain, or a goodly part of the pain, is simply from these messages that are going from the skin to the brain saying, wait a minute, the invaders are here and we need to get really upset about that.
Exactly. The brain does not like to receive that information. Interesting enough, when you talk about kidneys, kidney and most of the other internal organs are similar to the brain in that they don't have huge amounts of nerves attached to them. But the skin is very richly endowed with nerves, and
mm-hmm.
once you block that signal, it becomes a completely different game for the patient's brain. And many people used to criticize my advocacy of this over the years because they said, well, Dr. Friedberg, you're just doing cosmetic surgery. It's only fat and muscle. How much pain can people have? But 2 years ago, I had exactly the same set of circumstances done when I had my own total hip replacement. And every anesthesiologist I talked to couldn't understand what that 50 milligrams of ketamine 3 minutes beforehand would do, because I had the same spinal anesthetic that everybody else at the hospital would get and the same propofol sedation. I had a brain monitor to be sure. And they said, well, what difference could that make? I said, well, you have to remember that I'm not a very good surgical candidate. My wife makes me cry when she does my pedicures, so I'm kind of a wimp, you know, when it comes to pain. And, I'm ashamed to admit it, but that's who I am. I'm not the kind of guy who's going to tough things out. So given that as the context of who was it being operated on, for 4 days after my total hip replacement, I took nothing for pain, not because I was being macho, but because I didn't have any pain. So to me, there's no question that a total hip replacement is very serious surgery with very serious postoperative pain issues. And the nurses on the floor were unaware of my little experiment, as it was. I wanted to know what 18 years worth of my patients, 5,000 patients, were experiencing. And I said, I'd like to know if this is really good for everything. So when you can block the pain of a total hip replacement for 4 days with a simple 50 milligrams of ketamine 3 minutes before your incision, then it's clearly not just for cosmetic surgery. But again, the key is that
and
you have to measure the brain.
The common name for this strategy is the Goldilocks procedure?
That's what I call it. It's the brain monitor in conjunction with the propofol and the ketamine. Propofol ketamine is what I was talking about for years and years. But the reason I call it Goldilocks is when I started brain monitoring my patients in 1997, they'd say, why are you putting that sticky patch on my head, Dr. Friedberg? And I would explain that if your brain is dictating to me how much drug to give you, then I can't give you too much and I can't give you too little. It's always just right. The more times I kept saying this, the more I kept thinking about the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, where the porridge wasn't too hot and it was too cold. It was just right. And so it became easier to communicate with my patients the reason to have their brain monitor. And I would say, well, this is Goldilocks anesthesia. And unless they were Spanish, they understood me right away. The Hispanic community knows Goldilocks as Ricitos de Oro, the golden-haired one. Yes, it was a great piece of cross-cultural communication that I was able to conquer here in Southern California, where we have a fair number of Spanish-speaking people.
That's right, that's right. Oh, very clever. Now, you mentioned a couple of times a brain monitor. So tell us what a brain monitor is.
The first of the current generation, there's about six companies that make brain monitors, and the one that was first in the field, much like the Xeroxes and the IBMs of the world, was called the BIS monitor, B-I-S. And they predominate in the field, but the Goldilocks Anesthesia Foundation isn't promoting their particular brand of technology. It's promoting the concept of you shouldn't have anesthesia that you're going unconscious from without having somebody measure what they're medicating, which is your brain. And so the Goldilocks principle is that measuring is better than guessing. And that's a self-evident thing if you haven't been indoctrinated in the belief system that I was in 1975, that heart rate and blood pressure changes were a clue to what's going on in your brain. So to compensate for the fact that we really didn't know what was going on in your brain, we were just good guessers, and all the things we would ask people about preoperatively were designed to help us to give a better guesstimate of how much medication to give and how big a dose. None of that really matters nearly as much as the ability to directly be able to measure how your brain is responding as an individual. Because with a brain monitor, well, let's put it this way, without a brain monitor, you are a mystery to you're a mystery to the anesthesiologist every time you have to have surgery and anesthesia. With a brain monitor, your brain becomes an open book to the anesthesiologist. He can't read your thoughts. That's not the point. But he does know exactly how his medication is affecting your brain, so he doesn't have to routinely over-medicate you. By the way, one patient a day dies from anesthesia over-medication, and that was just reported in last year's number one journal in anesthesia. And compared to the number of millions of people who get anesthesia, one patient a day is a rather small number, but if it's avoidable by the use of a monitor that requires a $20 disposable sensor, most people would think that their life is probably worth more than $20.
Yes, I would say so. Now, is this a kind of a machine that would be commonly used in especially the larger teaching hospitals?
I believe it's up to 80% of the teaching hospitals in the United States have this equipment, and overall about 60% of all U.S. hospitals have them. Unfortunately, they're only used about 20% of the time, which is...
Why would you not use one as an anesthesiologist? It seems like it's cheap insurance.
It is. It is. And I get asked that question all the time because obviously I'm advocating the use of them, and it's a very deep question that can be answered on many levels. But I said something the other day that I hadn't ever said before, and I thought was maybe a little easier for people to understand. It always comes back to money. But basically, hospitals and surgery centers are acute care hospitals, acute care facilities. And as long as they don't kill you providing the surgery that you're there for, they feel that their task is done. Unfortunately, if in the process of doing that, they over-medicate you and leave you less than the same person you were when you came in, that's not their problem. But it's your problem and society's problem, especially if the anesthesia over-medication triggers an Alzheimer's dementia.
So I'm trying to understand the mentality of them seeing themselves as an acute care facility. I can certainly see that in an emergency room situation, but if I schedule surgery for, yes, I don't know, having my appendix out or whatever, I don't consider that emergency care. I don't consider that acute care.
No, it's
care.
Not if emergency
it's,
care.
If it's scheduled.
Emergency and acute. Acute as opposed to chronic. In other words, a nursing home is a chronic facility, chronic care facility. A hospital
uh-huh.
is
okay.
acute care because you're coming in for a specific procedure typically, your appendix or my hip replacement, for instance, you're not expected to spend the next several months there.
Right, right.
Okay, so that's what I'm talking about when I say it's an acute care facility. They perform whatever it is that you came in to have done, typically a surgical procedure. And if you're
okay.
not exactly the same person you were when you went to sleep, they have no, they don't have any, it's not on their radar. It doesn't impact what they do. They didn't kill you, and they feel their job is done.
Well, it certainly is on the patient's radar, for heaven's sake. So if I go
well,
in
that's
for
the goal of the
whatever
foundation.
Surgery,
that is precisely what we're trying to create an awareness
right.
among the American public that they need to be concerned about their brains, because while the hospital's done what they're doing with your surgical procedure, you have to live with what's left of your brain after they've done giving you your anesthesia. And people who
right.
are over
so
50,
how can we as patients protect ourselves?
Ah, an excellent question. Excellent question. When you talk to your surgeon on your first visit and you've decided
mm-hmm.
that you're going to have a surgical procedure, the Goldilocks Anesthesia Foundation has a list of 9 questions that readers, visitors, listeners can go to and download for free. And one of the things that's important to start the conversation with is the first question, which is a leading question. And when you ask the surgeon, does he know that anesthesia over medication is a routine without a brain monitor, it opens the door to this discussion. And what you want to find out from the surgeon is if he's going to have do your surgery in a facility where this type of monitoring is regularly done. And more importantly, if it's not done, tell him you have to go where it is being done or you have to go elsewhere. And this is
so,
obviously only the case for
tell
like
me the way
surgery.
You phrased that question again. The question
did you
number
know
one.
That anesthesia over medication is a routine without a brain monitor? In other words, Joyce, if I can't talk to you and you can't talk back to me.
Let me just react to that because
sure.
that sounds like to me like a challenging question that would raise the hackles of the person I'm talking with. If it were me, I wouldn't want to phrase it that way. But
okay,
why do
you
choose
phrase
to
it,
phrase it that way?
Okay, how would you phrase it?
I would say that are you going to be using a brain monitor?
Well, that's question two.
I mean, the first one, it sounds like he could take offense at question one, whereas if I simply say, are you going to be using a brain monitor, then he either says, oh, of course I always do, or he says, oh, I think that's, you know, voodoo medicine, and in which case you go in a different direction.
Right, right. Well, most likely he's going to say, that's not my area of expertise. You'll have to talk to the anesthesia people about that. And you'll say, great, how can I get hold of them?
Well, now, before your surgery, the night before the surgery, usually, the anesthesiologist comes in and has this little conversation with you. Is it better to have the conversation then, or you're saying you should raise this with your urologist or whoever the primary doctor is on this case?
Yes, I think first of all, most patients get admitted to the hospital on the day of surgery. The old days of the anesthesiologist coming around to see you the night before sort of ended even in my era in the mid-1980s. Now even patients for open heart surgery come in the morning of surgery because it saves a night of hospitalization when they don't have to be there unless they're medically unstable for some reason. So basically you want to make this situation known well beforehand, because if you don't, mm-hmm. once you're on the gurney on your way down the hall to the operating room, it's not going to happen. And if you don't,
you're committed at that point.
You're committed, right, exactly.
Yeah.
So if you don't care about your own brain and you don't care how well you function mentally in your life, then you don't worry about offending people who might say, well, geez, what do you mean about anesthesia over medication without a brain monitor?
Well, I certainly care about my brain more than about offending someone. But yes. Let's see, is there another way to get to the anesthesiologist before the day of the surgery?
Yes, yes. You find out who this person usually works with. There are a number of ways that hospitals work, but most commonly, at least in California, hospitals, anesthesiologists are contracted to the hospital. They usually have an office. You can contact them, and you can determine at least if that is a routine at the hospital or not a routine, or you can determine whether there are younger anesthesiologists who are more likely to be using this type of monitoring for whom you would like to request them to take care of you. Because basically you're not interested in having a philosophic discussion with the anesthesiologist, does or doesn't believe in brain monitoring. You're not interested in that. The only thing you're interested in is to make sure that they don't lose a few of the marbles that you've managed to hang on to.
Absolutely. So if with your major doctor, you say, I've been reading some stuff that says that how important it is to use a brain monitor, can you tell me if brain monitors are definitely going to be used at this hospital, or who can I talk with about that?
Absolutely.
Right?
That's a wonderful way to talk about the conversation. You know, it's just there are lots of ways to introduce the material, but it has to be on your mind because you're the only one who's really going to benefit from this. You see, the hospital has no billing code, you know, that they charge for everything that's in the hospital. I don't know if you've ever looked at a hospital bill to see what they charge for Tylenol, but it's pretty impressive.
$18 for an aspirin, right?
Right, exactly. So you can imagine for a $20 sensor, they'd be charging probably $200 to the insurance company, maybe getting $80 or $100 and being able to use that to help their operating costs. But they don't have a billing code, so the hospital doesn't make any money because they can't find a way to bill for that $20 sensor. The anesthesiologist doesn't make anything extra. There's no modifier on his anesthesia bill, so he doesn't make any more money. And the only people who really stand to lose big time, aside from you and your brain, are the drug companies that make the drugs for the anesthesiologist. Because if
should we be working to get a billing code on the Medicare list so that this
well, it
can
would
be
a wonderful
for.
Thing. Would be a wonderful thing, Joyce, but it's been tried for many years without any success whatsoever. Medicare has the same opinion that the hospital has, that if they don't kill you while you had your surgery, well, that's good enough for them. And
well, no,
again,
because Medicare winds up paying for you in your disability, too, so it makes no economic sense. They certainly
makes
have no axe to grind in that direction. And, I think we ought to try to take the positive route if we can here, and let's make some noise about this, because if the lack of a billing code is one of the things that's discouraging people from using such a life-saving thing that they probably already own, for heaven's sake, then we should be pushing for that. I can campaign for that.
I would think that'd be a wonderful thing, and I'm sure the people who make these monitors would be happy to have your assistance, but I can tell you right now that they've tried for a decade to try to get a billing code to get this recognized. And see, that's the very issue when you say life-saving. Medicare and the insurance companies don't view the quality of your mental recovery from anesthesia as life-saving. After all, you didn't die. But how many people have you known or friends have known that have had surgery and anesthesia, and they were mostly there, but they weren't exactly the same person they were before they had their surgery. And that's
well, let's take a little poll. All of you who are listening to this recording, if you care about the health of your brain after the surgery, please raise your hand. Now, come on. That's unanimous. You and I both know that.
Of course,
right?
Of course.
So I think we just need, this is the first I've heard of it, and I've done a lot of hospital time, let me tell you, and my husband and my son, between the two of them, have probably had more than 30 surgeries. So this is the first I've ever heard of this, and I think we need to raise the consciousness of the patient population and get the patients out there arguing for it. I mean, the company makes the brain monitor, when they go and say we need a